Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University.
Your brain's prefrontal cortex is your inner grown-up. It helps you remember where you put your keys and makes you organized enough to pack a suitcase. And it lets you know that you should not make that witty remark about your boss's comb-over during your performance review. This is Colleen Shaddix for the Yale Office of Public Affairs, talking with Dr. Amy Arnston, who's working to disarm your prefrontal cortex's natural enemy, stress. When did we really start studying stress in human beings scientifically?
Well, Colleen, a lot of this work began after World War II, when the British noticed that many pilots who were excellent pilots in peacetime were crashing their planes when they were under stress. Mm. So they started studying the effects of stress on higher cognitive function, and they found that especially when we're asked to do complex tasks, things that involve a lot of decision-making and switching of our attention and, of course, remembering things, we're very bad under stress. Whereas if we're doing something that's very automatic, mm-hmm. well-rehearsed, something we've been trained to do, we can actually be better. And I think this is really the basis of boot camp, where you're really being trained, ingrained, to do some series of complex things where you don't have to think about it. So if you're in an emergency situation, you can do the right thing without having to use your prefrontal cortex. Because it's the prefrontal cortex, we now understand, that is needed for all those complex decision-making, memory, attention tasks. And it's stress that's impairing prefrontal function.
Now that seems kind of an evolutionary whammy to throw at humanity. Wouldn't you want your prefrontal cortex to really be working terrifically in a survival situation?
Well, you know, if cavemen were flying planes, I think we would have evolved differently. But this is a system that has evolved to keep us safe in danger in the wild. And I had an experience that really illustrated this to me. I was walking along a dirt road in Vermont, quietly all by myself, and down from a tree just a few feet away from me dropped a huge brown bear. And I tell you, I froze without having to think about, oh, bears can't see moving objects. I think I should stop moving so mm-hmm. he won't see me. So I had all these habits, that instincts that were ingrained in me to just freeze, and I assure you I wasn't being very thoughtful at that moment. So having my prefrontal cortex go offline and these very primitive instincts coming to the fore saved me when I was in danger. But having the same thing happen to me when I'm up giving a speech or taking an SAT, then it's not such an advantage. And very often in our modern life in mm-hmm. particular, having stress impair our prefrontal function has really disastrous consequences.
Yeah, most of us don't encounter bears every day. So how is this shutdown of the prefrontal cortex limiting our ability to lead happy, healthy lives?
Well, in particular, when we have bad habits, such as overeating or smoking, drinking alcohol to excess, our prefrontal cortex is usually the part of our brain that's able to say, you know, let's not reach for that donut. Let's have the grape nuts instead. Mm-hmm. And if this part of our brain is offline because we're stressed, then we give in to all these bad habits. And this can be particularly problematic in severe stress disorders like post-traumatic stress disorder, where people have experienced really traumatic stress. And in this case, the prefrontal cortex normally helps us to inhibit thinking about traumatic memories, mm-hmm. the kind of, I don't need to think about that right now. Right now I need to be taking care of my daughter and not thinking about when I was raped. And the prefrontal cortex lets us have that foot in the door to be able to do that effectively. When the prefrontal cortex goes offline, we end up with symptoms like post-traumatic stress disorder with flashbacks and all these intrusive memories, depression, and other stress-linked disorders.
What's actually happening physically inside the brain when we're experiencing extreme troublesome stress?
The brain has chemical stress reactions just like the body does. So as most people appreciate, when we're under stress, our adrenal glands release adrenaline and also cortisol, and our sympathetic nervous system releases norepinephrine. And adrenaline and norepinephrine both act on our heart and our lungs and our muscle to enhance their function for fight and flight, give our muscles lots of oxygenated blood. But they do the opposite thing to our stomachs. Our digestive system is actually shut down under conditions of high stress chemicals. And the thought is you don't have to digest your lunch in order to not become someone else's lunch, right, such as that bear. Well, the same thing happens in the brain. You have a flood of chemicals released, norepinephrine, just like in the body, and then another chemical called dopamine. And dopamine and norepinephrine take the prefrontal cortex offline just as if it was the stomach also. It's the slow digestive part of the brain, thoughtful, reflective, inhibiting us. And at the same time, these chemicals enhance the function of our sensory and motor parts of our brain, of our emotional parts of our brain, our primitive instinctive parts of our brain. And so we flip from being these intelligent, thoughtful, rather slow creatures to someone who's very reflexive and more primitive. And so if we have the right habits there to fall back on, we can do the right thing. But oftentimes the situation requires that we figure out something new, that we use memory and higher logic to solve a problem, and then we're in trouble.
And when that trouble happens, since we know what's taking the prefrontal cortex offline, have you found ways to get it back online?
We have been working to develop medications that people can take, and some of these have already been successful. So, for example, the drug prazosin, which is a generic compound used to treat high blood pressure out there for many years, mm-hmm. Is now being used to treat post-traumatic stress disorder based on our work, including being given to vets returning from the Iraqi war. And also what has made me feel very good, even to people with very long established PTSD, for example, survivors of Auschwitz, mm-hmm. who as they've become older have really become haunted by these memories. And the prazosin apparently helps them not have nightmares, not have to think about those horrible memories, and survive better. We're also testing some other medications to see if they might help with more everyday problems, such as the ability to resist things like smoking. And that's one of the studies that's going on in the Stress Consortium here at Yale.
Now, most medication traditionally that's been given to combat stress has had a sedative effect, and I'm presuming the things that you're talking about would not.
Some of them do have that as a side effect, so that may be a limiting factor for some of them. But we're trying, by understanding the mechanisms, to have it be truly therapeutic and not just having people made sleepier.
So, an enemy plane coming at you, a bear in the woods, these are situations where you really don't have that much control over your environment. How much does that play into the stress response?
That is actually a critical factor. Studies in humans and animals have shown that feeling in control, even if it's an illusion, is key to the prefrontal cortex staying online and cognitive abilities staying intact. So, for example, people who thought they had control of a stress, even though they didn't, showed no cognitive impairment. And we're learning from studies, for example, in labs out in Colorado, that the prefrontal cortex is the one that's determining whether you're in control or not. And if it even has the illusion of control, it goes down and turns off the stress pathways. And this might be what happens in a lot of traditional therapies, whereas people gain insight about what's bothering mm-hmm. them, they feel more in control and they're able to normalize their stress chemistry.
Now, you mentioned the stress pathways. Do we all have the same stress pathways?
There are new, very exciting data that there are genetic changes in some of the molecules in the stress pathways in families with high incidence of mental illness. So this has been a really exciting breakthrough that there may be these genetic weaknesses in the very molecules that provide the brakes on the stress pathways that normally rein them in, and that if we could then substitute for these broken genes with the proper medications, we might be able to be helpful to these patients.
And these are a lot of illnesses where medication's been problematic in the past, is that correct?
That's right. So, for example, bipolar disorder and schizophrenia and major depression have all been linked to genes, especially bipolar and schizophrenia, to genes that are very key in these stress pathways. And as most people appreciate, these are illnesses that are very stress sensitive, and it's very often exposure to a stressor that precipitates a manic episode or causes a worsening in psychotic symptoms. So understanding it at the molecular level may be very helpful.
Thank you. We've been talking with Dr. Amy Arnston about her work with the Yale Stress Center and Interdisciplinary Research Consortium on Stress, Self-Control, and Addiction. For more information, please visit yalestress.org.